Frank, show them your pictures of your stuff. Tell us how you're getting these things. Bring it up to my desk.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order, Mr. President. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a very important hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 26. We have a number of bills before this committee dealing with this subject, which is building a robust rainy day fund. We decided to just post this bill. It has most of the concepts in it. And I want to send the message out loud and clear that this is very much a work in progress, and that a lot of the people in this room are going to be participants in the form of the final bill. And I also want to give special recognition to Senator Morse, who really worked hard getting this bill as far as it is in Senate Joint Resolution 26. So today we are going to start out with a brief summary from Paul, and then we'll move into our opening panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've just put together a one-page summary titled SGR 26 Constitutional Revision. And really, it just breaks up the bill into four main components. The first describes the mandatory saving process, in which projected revenue is broken into three components. The first component of that projected revenue growth is allocated to maintain the budget, and it consists of the sum of population growth and inflation from the prior 2 years. The second segment above that growth rate, up to 3%, would go to mandatory savings, would be unappropriated, and would be not appropriated during the budget development process. The final segment would be what's the remainder, the difference between the projected revenue growth and the amount that goes to cover to population inflation in the mandatory savings. That amount would be available for budgeting purposes. The second major element of the bill, of the constitutional revision, is to place the Oregon Rainy Day Fund in the Constitution. Most of those provisions that would be in the Constitution or in the statute now from House Bill 2707 from the 07 session, which created the statutory rainy day fund. It retains an ending balance up to 1% of appropriations in the prior biennium. That's in current statute. It transfers up to 3% of the unappropriated revenue, which is the mandatory savings, if actual revenue equals or exceeds projected revenue used to calculate the growth index at the beginning of the biennium. So in other words, if actual revenue is equal to or above projected revenue, then the 3% that was unappropriated goes into the fund. And then it allocates 50% of excess revenue as determined by the 2% personal kicker calculation and puts that into the reserve fund. It caps the fund at 12% and retains a two-thirds limit on the amount that can be withdrawn on any one biennium. The other main element of the revision is that it establishes the Oregon University Stability Fund. Uses the same funds to access the Stability Fund as we have in the Rainy Day Fund. And it directs the surplus corporate income tax revenue into the Oregon University Stability Fund. The allocations from the fund are for purposes that benefit higher education institutions and activities. When the fund is reached, when its cap is reached, which is 15% of general fund appropriations to the Oregon University system in the prior biennium, when that is reached, any additional revenue would flow into a subaccount, which is a university capital improvement and maintenance fund. So additional revenue would go into that fund. Finally, just to sum up, the revision does change the kicker provisions that are in the Constitution. It allocates 50% of the personal kicker to the Oregon Rainy Day Fund that would be in the Constitution as well until the cap is reached. Once the cap is reached, then it restores the full kicker refund. Then it directs any excess revenues determined by the 2% corporate kicker calculation to the Oregon University Stability Fund. And I do have for the committee a historical simulation looking at how the fund would have been, how the rainy day fund would have been filled up historically over the last 10 biennia.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to start off our testimony today with our Honorable Senate President and our Honorable House Member, Senator Peter Courtney, and Representative Andy Olson.
Thank you. checking out. That's sort of pretty much.
Did you make a mess or what?
Yes, sir.
I'm glad to see your full service, Representative Olson.
Thank you.
You're in good company. Courtney.
Proceed.
Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Morris and Vice Chair Telfer, Redistricting Committee, and Chair of All Education, Senator Hass. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive, Northeast here in Salem, Oregon, 97303. I'm a State Senator, District 11. The chair of this august committee asked me to come here today and testify. She demanded I come here today and testify. I did not volunteer for this. And when she first asked me to come, I said no. And my staff said, yes, you're going to do it. I said, I don't care. I'm not going to do it. They said, that's fine. So I'm here. I'm here to thank you for beginning your work on kicker reform. You don't have to do this, especially during these very difficult times. You could deal with ordinary revenue issues. You could maintain the status quo and still have an extraordinarily successful session. But you have decided to do something, I'll just say it, courageous, in my humble opinion. To take on a job that could be a game changer for Oregon and for Oregon's future. Creating a workable reserve fund is critical to the long-term budgetary stability of this great state. Budget stability is critical to providing the services Oregonians count on most. A good education for children, care for the most vulnerable, and making sure that our streets and our communities are safe. I'm not the only one who feels this way, and now you're going to have to indulge me because this is ordinarily what I don't do. I'm going to give you a litany of things that have been said by different players. In a joint op-ed in the Oregonian, former State Representative Lane Shirley, tremendous respect I have for him, and Tony Van Vliet, they called for reforming the kicker and creating a rainy day fund so we can avoid having to make the devastating cuts to essential services that we currently face without a sufficient reserve draw. The former governor, Theodore Ralph Kulongoski, said Oregonians need to reform the kicker so we can stop budgeting from crisis to crisis. In 2008, a study by the Pew Center, the famous Pew Center for the states, blamed Oregon's kicker law for the state's precarious financial position, rating kicker reform as the number one thing the state could do to better manage its budget. The Oregon Business Plan in 2009 said kicker reform is long overdue. The most recent Oregon Business Plan calls for directing personal and corporate kickers to reserves until the rainy day fund is full. The Oregonian editorial board called kicker reform tax reform that Oregon most needs. Joe Courtwright, a member of Governor Kulongoski's Council of Economic Advisors, said it is increasingly clear that the kicker makes no sense whatsoever. Oregonian conservative columnist Susan Nielsen called the need to reform the kicker a no-brainer. Many more of our fellow citizens from all walks of life, all political persuasions, have urged us, begged us to reform the kicker and build a reserve. That so many people from so many corners of our state and country agree that Oregon needs kicker reform is very important. And this is where it gets dicey for you. If we are going to address an issue this significant and this controversial, the legislature proposal must be bipartisan, and it must be one that will garner support from all of the affected parties. It cannot be D versus R. It cannot be business versus labor. It cannot be even the House versus the Senate. It was with this in mind that I structured this committee. I put two Democrats and two Republicans on this committee. I chose the four of you. The four of you. It's now Burdick, Morris, Telfer, and Hass time. Knowing the four of you, I'm not surprised that you are taking this courageous step of even holding a hearing on this issue. In a way, you are just being Oregonians, because Oregonians have never been afraid to try things others said were impossible. Early in my career, oh yeah, I remember this, I join with a veteran lawmaker to propose a major restructuring of our tax system. It took us 2 years to put it together, and I failed. I failed. I've learned a lot along the way, and I think this one just might be doable. This may be the time for kicker reform, especially with the four of you. The four of you. I don't mean to be too dramatic, but I do believe the world, our world, is watching. They want to see if you can find the path that accounts for how strongly Oregonians feel about the kicker and how desperately our state needs a stable reserve fund. It will be those Oregon voters who ultimately decide whether to reform the kicker and create a rainy day fund. You know that whatever you do will be either become a legislative referendum or will be referred to the ballot by the public. This is where the work begins, here today at this hearing. It may seem like a long journey, but let me close with a famous statement my wife gave to me years ago, and particularly she used to give it to our sons. Begun is half done, and you have begun. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Andy Olson. I am state representative from the Albany area. Just want to say, again, thanks for this opportunity to be in front of you here. If you notice, I happen to be a co-sponsor of SJR 26, and I believe the measure funds the common ground for fiscal stability between those who believe the solution lies in strict mandated savings and those who believe reform of the kicker is the solution. Now, you have my notes, actually written testimony, but I'd like to just read a little bit to that and share a little bit with you on that, and I won't go through the whole thing. As I consider the significance of this legislation, I believe it would be helpful for all legislators to thoughtfully reflect on the responsibilities given to us by voters. Certainly one of the most important, if not the most important, responsibilities is to provide fiscal stability for our most critical services. And you have to ask yourself some major questions, I think. When the economy falters, is the need to care for those most vulnerable citizens less? When tax revenues decline and budget holes get deeper and deeper, is there less need to educate our children? When we try to create a business climate that attracts capital and jobs, can we effectively do so when our schools close in order to balance budgets? And the last major question, when we have deep budget holes to fill, does it make sense to raise taxes when businesses are struggling to stay alive? All this is to say that fiscal stability is critically important to the future of our state, and we must find solutions. SJR 26 is a solution that blends the fiscal ideologies of mandated savings, a thoughtful spending limitation, and kicker reform. It is a measure that will not only help stabilize critical services, it will make Oregon an attractive place to do business. When we recruit businesses to locate here, we can assure employees and employers that their children will have a full school year and will have safe communities to live in. And finally, we have an opportunity here in this session to get Oregon on a new course. Several years ago, John Maxwell wrote a book that was called The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. It's one of my favorite leadership books. But one of the chapters, one of the laws that he described, dealt with the law of navigation. And the premise of the law of navigation is simple. Anyone can steer a ship, but it takes a leader to chart a course. And you have this given to you now, actually, to move forward with charting a course and to build a better Oregon. So I thank you for taking this time listening to me.
Thank you, and I want to thank you both for your heartfelt remarks. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Before we get into our panels, I have deputized someone out there in the audience. His name is Lynn Lundquist, and he is the former Speaker of the House. He is the former president of the Oregon Business Council, and he was talking about the Rainy Day Fund before any of us even knew it was raining. So welcome, Lynn.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick, Senators Moore, Senator Hass, and Senator Telfer. It's really a pleasure to be here today. When I've never been deputized before, but I can tell you I'm not packing, so it's probably okay.
In this group, that's a good thing.
I believe that Lane Shetterly was also invited to come and couldn't attend today, and I'm sorry he's not here. I'd love to be up here at this podium with Lane. We both are somewhat equally ignorant. When we came into the legislature, we both shared one common theme. Neither one of us joined the PERS system because we thought of a conflict of interest, and I think the main conflict was with my pocketbook later on. But Lane, I think we'll be later on probably, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And when you say that I'm supposed to present or try to present a little bit of history, the first thing that goes through my mind is that means I'm not the youngest person in the world, I think, around this room today. But if we look at the kicker law, it was passed in 79 by the legislature and passed by the people in 1980. So it's roughly, I'd say it's 31 years old today, or in this timeline. It's gone through 15 biennia, not including the 09, 011, since we're not quite through that yet. It actually was a part of an overall fiscal reform package. And my personal opinion is that probably that fiscal analysis was done more with an axe than with a scalpel. I absolutely believe that. The next two biennia, interestingly enough, after the passage of the measure, both the next two biennium, the projections were less than, was less than projections. And I think that's interesting, about 6% less. So it shows they had this sort of course they were talking about, and all of a sudden it went off the boat the other way, went off the cliff. The combined personal and corporate kicker since its inception is about $3.6 billion. However, about $600 million of that has been suspended for one reason or another, and by far the largest portion that was suspended was a $344 for the corporate kicker, as you remember just a short time ago. On the other side of the ledger, the actual revenue that has been less than forecasted, so it's the other side of the coin here, was about $5.1 billion. And actually, 82% of that has occurred during the 0103, 0709, and 09-11 biennium, and I'm sure you're all painfully aware of that scenario and the difficulties made for your job. And to further sort of, I think, emphasize the illogicalness of the corporate the kicker, is there's a good chance there's going to be a corporate kicker this biennium. So in the times we find ourselves needing resources to provide essential services, and the next biennium, I think, you know, as the economy tends to improve, as economists we tend to be conservative, and so it's not impossible that the next biennium we will actually have a personal and a corporate kicker. I mean, that, I think, if you follow the trend, if you look back and look what's happened in history, that could very well be the case. There have been many battles fought over the kicker in these halls, and I've been a part of that. I remember when I was a freshman legislator and President Gordon Smith called me quite a few times and talked to me saying, Lynn, I need you to support the fact that we want to make the remuneration from the kicker to the public not off your tax form but on a check. And there was one reason to do that. It was to put into the people's minds it's almost like an entitlement. I have to admit I voted for that and I wish I hadn't have. Because I think it's made it more difficult when you have that check going out that way. I personally have always tried to be realistic and logical in analyzing all policies, particularly fiscal policies. Opponents of this bill, in my opinion, and this is my opinion, I think don't follow that course of action. There's too much emotions involved in this. We need to look at this as a straight fiscal situation. However, having said that, I completely agree with those that are very vocal stating that government should run like a business. I absolutely believe that. The only major difference between the business and government is that businesses primarily produce widgets and government primarily produces services. Sure, government needs to tighten its belt in tough times. I absolutely believe that. The government needs to be lean and mean. Crook County, just in the last couple years, my pushing, the employees now pay 20% of their medical insurance costs. But I think those are the kinds of things that have to happen. But when you compare businesses and government, it's not apples and apples, it's just apples and oranges. In the business world, which I've been a part of for all my life, not as successful as Senator Morris has been. I commend you for what you've accomplished over the, I really do, over your life, and coming here and giving of their time now. But businesses, why do they lay people off? They tighten their belt. Why do they do that? They do it because there's not a demand for their products. You don't find a business laying off people if they need those people to service the public. In government, as stated before by President Courtney, as you all know, the services required are larger, not less, during a recessionary period. So, what is the appropriate fiscal policy to contend with this phenomena that the government needs to be able to provide services during tough times? I would propose this. Cutting waste and increasing efficiency, that's a no-brainer. But will that be enough to fulfill the government's obligations? And notice I said obligations. I didn't say desires. I said they're obligations. No, I don't think it is enough. And history has proven this over and over, time and time again, not to mention Doonesbury, et cetera, that have happened in times past. To me, the answer is as obvious as a stark naked jaybird on the Capitol's lawn. Families, businesses, and government must have adequate reserves. Here in Oregon, as you know, we call it a rainy day fund. I don't like the title because people say it always rains in Oregon. And if it rains in Oregon, you're going to use these reserves. I remember when I was running before I was even elected. I remember in Baker City particularly once where I was really hammered because I was promoting this. This was my major agenda as a freshman legislator, was it's always going to be spent. I believe your bill has adequate requirements that will keep that from happening. To me, we don't need any more discussion about that. The discussion that is critical is how do we build adequate reserves? That's the discussion. We have a start, of course, with the Education Endowment Fund and with the ending balance funding stream. But the most obvious way to me is the kicker. It's just that simple. And I appreciate particularly Senator Morris and Burdick and all of you for taking, as President Courtney said, having the pizzazz and the determination to say, let's take a shot at this. That's important. In 1997, I was Speaker. I helped pass House Bill 2007. It actually didn't have all the safety issues to the same degree that you have. It didn't have as far as limiting spending in two bienniums rather than one. Like you say, you can only spend so much in one biennium. But it did pass. And I think, Senator Burke, I believe you were there. And I can't remember if Senator Hass was there at the time or not. But it passed 43-16. That's bipartisan. You heard the President, the Senate say we need to be bipartisan. It was. Unfortunately, it got to the Revenue Committee on the Senate side and died. I needed all you people at that time, but you weren't here. Where were you, I guess, would be my comment. So speaking specifically to the bills, I have simply a food for thought and a serious request. The food for thought is this. And I've talked to Senator Morris about this a little bit. I know in this bill, the provisions provide that 50% of the kicker goes back to the public and 50% stays in the rainy day fund or goes in the rainy day fund. I get it. I understand why you want to do that. I've talked to quite a few people. It's just my instinct, and I'm just throwing it out as a thought-provoking process. I wonder how many people will support the measure because they're getting 50% rather than not getting any. My experience has been that most people, they're either for it or against it. Now, the polling will give you an indication, and I'm not saying you should change that provision. I just say think about it because remember what I said before? In the total time since it's been, in 30 years, we've had $3 billion, roughly, in kicker. We need to be able to build a reserve, and we can't take forever to do it. So obviously, I think all of you would agree you'd rather have all of it. I don't know if that's the right outcome or not, but I wish you'd give it some thought. Now, my serious request. take this bill, massage it, manipulate it, alter it, strategize, plead, beg, or whatever you have to do, and work like hell to make this become a reality. I say that in all sincerity. It won't happen otherwise. Someone has to take up, some group of people have to take up the cause. This is not a situation where you can pass a bill and see what the House does with it. It's a matter, it has to be worked. There has to be advocates for it. And I say that, sure, there are other ways to change fiscal policy, but I agree with Senator Courtney. This is the only way that's viable today, and it's the one that we must have an opportunity to say, we tried. If we fail, it's okay. It's not okay, I guess, but at least we tried. I think this is too important to sit on the sidelines, as some people might want to do, not the four of you, and say, you know, let's just see what happens. And then when it gets to the people, that's the second challenge. And if we can do a bipartisan support out of here, and I'll just pledge you this personally, I will do everything I can inside the building and outside to help make this become a reality, because that's the kind of commitment that's going to take. The Benn Bulletin, in closing this, let me say this. The Benn Bulletin recently came with an editorial, Senator Telford probably saw that, criticizing this bill because they say it doesn't restrain spending enough. I get a little tired of those who want to just have less government. We need to have not less government, we need to have efficient government. We need to have productive government. That's different. If all you want is less government, then go out and promote unemployment. Let's have recessions. That makes less government. And that is not what we want. I am going to go visit with the Benn Bulletin editorial board and see what I can do to talk about this and see if we can have another shot at that. That's what's going to happen. Have to happen. Chair Burdick, senators, I commend you for doing this. And I hope that you will be successful. And I'm going to do the best I can to make that so. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will take you up on that. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Our opening panel today is Darren Bond from the State Treasurer's Office, Pat Wrighton, President of Pacific Corps and President of the Oregon Business Plan, and Curtis Robinhold from the Governor's Office. Welcome. Go ahead and start, Curtis.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Curtis Robinhold, Governor Kitzhaber's Chief of Staff. I come before the committee today to speak on behalf of Governor Kitzhaber in support of the modification of Oregon's income tax kicker law. The governor believes that building a framework for sustained prosperity in Oregon requires fundamental changes to our revenue structure. In a number of areas, as you know, Oregon is exposed to fluctuations in national and global economic trends. In particular, Oregon's reliance on income taxes results in an unstable revenue source for essential state services. At the state level, we rely too heavily on personal and corporate income taxes, drawing over 90% of state revenues from that single source. I believe the number is 93%. This dependence on one source of revenue creates volatility and jeopardizes long-term stable funding of key services. In tough economic times, as witnessed by the recession we've just passed through, state revenues fluctuate wildly and Oregon schools and healthcare systems suffer. Like all Oregon families, as Lynn Lundquist just mentioned, and small businesses who seek to set aside some savings for those tough times, the governor believes Oregon should have the ability to do the same thing, putting some money aside during good times for use in bad times when it's needed. The current kicker law prevents just this kind of good sense planning. Governor Kitzhaber supports the creation of a stable rainy day fund as a part of an overall plan to grow Oregon's economy and stabilize spending on essential state services. To do this, the governor supports modification of the kicker law to create a well-capitalized savings account with very tight controls. He believes in using the kicker to first fill a reserve fund that will protect Oregonians from service cuts and tax increases during recessions. I thank you for giving me the opportunity today to address one very promising potential remedy for this problem. Although we in the governor's office are still at work analyzing SGR 26, happy to work with you in the legislature in the future on this and any rainy day fund legislation. So thank you.
Thank you, and we will take you up on that. Darren?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer, here on behalf of Treasurer Ted Wheeler. I appreciate the opportunity also to speak on SJR 26 and agree with everything Curtis said. We were asked to comment specifically on the kicker as it relates to the state's credit rating and whether or not the question of the kicker negatively impacting the credit rating is real. And I am here to tell you the simple answer is yes. The kicker as designed is rightly viewed by the credit rating agencies as a significant impediment to the state's ability to establish adequate reserves. Those adequate reserves are critical to us being able to address the volatilities in our revenue streams, which we are all too familiar that we face. The rating agencies routinely point out to us that they're concerned with our heavy reliance on the income tax and our, what they believe, inadequate reserves. We're just as quick to point out that, you know, we have the Educational Stability Fund, we have the Rainy Day Fund, and, you know, we're doing all we can. And they are just as quick to come back with the fact that they don't believe that the Rainy Day Fund has a adequate, consistent source of revenue to fund it. They also point out that they're very aware that the Rainy Day Fund that we have established is a statutory construct, whereas the kicker is a constitutional construct, and they recognize the relative statement that they believe the state makes with that difference in structure. Additionally, they like to remind us that in Oregon, as Curtis indicated, with very heavy reliance on the personal income tax, we are uniquely dependent an extremely volatile source of revenue, which makes Oregon's need for adequate reserves greater than your typical state with a more diverse revenue stream. We believe that any effort to strengthen the Rainy Day Fund, such as the concepts in SJR 26, are positive. They'll be viewed positively by the rating agencies and will help the state to be able to maintain and hopefully improve its credit rating over time. The Treasurer supports a constitutional rainy day fund. He supports dedicated revenue stream for the rainy day fund. In fact, he believes that multiple revenue streams pointed towards the rainy day fund are important and applauds the legislature for the consideration of that here and in other legislation that will be before you this year. While the benefits of a robust rainy day fund are positive and from a budget and service delivery perspective and should, you know, argue for passage or for an effort like this, we would point out that a one-notch savings or a one-notch increase in the credit rating for the state amounts to about $4.3 million of savings on the 20-year average life of a $100 million bond issue. Those are savings that not only does the state get to realize, but school districts realize through use of the state school bond guarantee program. So that's my bit. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thanks.
Thank you. And I'll just tell the committee that Laura Lockwood McCall is here for more detailed questions if we have them. But right now we'll turn to Mr. Wrighton.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Moore, Senators. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here on what I think is an absolutely critical issue for our state.
You were just about to do it.
My name is Pat Wrighton. I serve both as the President of Pacific Power and as the Chair of the Oregon Business Plan Steering Committee. This topic is important to me in both capacities. Pacific Power serves 31 of 36 Oregon counties or has facilities. We've seen firsthand the underlying fundamentals driving reduced state revenues. As a company, the downturn has impacted us in many ways and required that we take extensive measures to assure that we're operating in a fiscally prudent manner so that we can continue meeting the needs of our customers. We expect no less of our state. Whether government or business, our customers and constituents expect us to operate on a sustainable basis so that they can count on us day in and day out. The theme that That theme was repeated in countless meetings across the state as we sought to take input from business and civic leaders during the creation of this year's Oregon Business Plan. We held no less than 17 meetings from Klamath Falls to Baker City, and heard in each of them that we need to deal with the volatility of tax revenues, as well as addressing fiscal policies that inhibit investment and job creation. The Oregon Business Plan has a number of goals for Oregon. They include creating 25,000 new jobs per year and Oregon per capita income above the national average by 2020. A robust rainy day fund is critical for meeting those goals. Our ability to train a qualified workforce depends on stable state revenues for education. That's why later in this hearing you'll hear from the presidents of Oregon's four largest business associations, all of whom had a role in shaping the plan's emphasis on creating a more sustainable state fiscal environment. Business advocacy for robust reserves is nothing new. It's been a key provision of the Oregon Business Plan since its inception in 2002. Business leaders were instrumental in establishing the Education Stability Fund in 2003 and successfully advocated for creation of the General Rainy Day Fund in 2007 with the dedication of the corporate kicker. We believe in this, we've supported it, and we support making it more robust and available when it's needed the most. For a reserve fund to be effective, it must be large enough to protect critical services during downturns. It should be placed in the Constitution with strict requirements about when it can be tapped in order to provide Oregonians the confidence that it will be there when they need it most. As a matter of fairness and to build the reserve to an adequate size, I believe the approach you've taken, which includes both the general fund contribution and dedication of some portion of the corporate and personal income tax kickers, is a good one. This is a key piece of the solution, but not the only piece. Oregon's per capita income has been declining compared to the national average of the nation for more than a decade, leaving us fewer dollars to pay for critical services. At the same time, the cost of health-related services has skyrocketed along with our spending on prisons and other programs, partly due to voter-approved initiatives. In addition to building reserves, Oregon must provide laser focus on improving the conditions for private sector job growth, the best source of revenue for the public sector, and on tackling the major cost drivers in the state budget. We've outlined 10 job creation ideas in the Oregon Business Plan, ranging from making more industrial land available to tax changes that will spark investment. If we follow through with those efforts together, Oregon will be on a path towards fiscal stability, and the Rainy Day Fund will have a lasting and meaningful impact for all Oregonians. None of this is easy. It takes real leadership. I want to thank you for laying out a bipartisan plan to solve a key piece of the puzzle and for taking it up today. On behalf of both the Oregon Business Plan Steering Committee and Pacific Power, I applaud your efforts.
Thank you very much. And committee, we will be submitting the Oregon Business Plan for the record for this hearing today.
Wonderful. Very much appreciated.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Now our next panel will be Duncan Wise from the Oregon Business Council, Ryan Deckert from the Oregon Business Association, Jay Clemens from AOI, and Sandy McDonough from the Portland Business Alliance. Duncan, you can just bring a chair up. Do they move?
We've got some over there.
We'll fit you in.
We can. We're small. I'm small enough to fit you.
Senator Deckert has offered to share. Former Senator Deckert. Okay. Welcome. I'll leave it to you. Who to start?
I think I got picked.
Welcome.
Chair Burdick and Senator Morse and members of the committee, we really appreciate the opportunity to be together in front of you today. We appreciate and join in others in applauding you for entering into this deep and meaningful discussion about the kicker and the tax structure and the reserve fund for the state of Oregon. My name is Jay Clemens. I'm president and CEO of Associated Oregon Industries. We are a large statewide general business association. We have about 1,600 members around the state, and they employ about 200,000 Oregonians. AOI regards SJR 26 as a serious and thoughtful proposal. AOI's board of directors has adopted three specific positions as it relates to a reserve fund, and I'd like to share those with you today. AOI supports modifying the state's reserve fund by creating a method for making regular deposits into the fund and making it part of the Oregon Constitution. We believe the legislature should put money into savings when times are good. Secondly, while AOI historically supports Oregon's 2% kicker law for a variety of reasons, we will support a portion of the kicker's monies being directed into a reserve fund contingent on general fund deposits into the fund. We would support a balanced approach that utilizes both kicker and general fund revenues. Thirdly, AOI supports a full return of kicker monies to taxpayers contingent on a fully funded reserve fund. Our reading of SJR 26 is that the personal kicker will be fully returned to taxpayers once the fund is capitalized. SJR 26 appears to fit well with AOI's positions on a reserve fund. However, we do not support dealing with the issues of a reserve fund in isolation. Rather, we believe the legislature should take the opportunity to tackle the broader issues of budget and tax reform, of which SJR 26 is a single component. AOI believes that the critical problem facing Oregon today stems from a lack of private sector jobs and lagging incomes. We believe growing quality jobs that produce good incomes must be our top priority. As such, we believe the first priority of the legislature must be to create long-term budget redesign that reforms the delivery of state services in a way that can be supported with our state's current and future economic activity with available revenues. That, by the way, is a significant component of the Oregon business plan. In other words, AOI would not support a reserve fund that would enable the state to continue to budget and deliver services in the same way as it occurs today. This approach is critical to the public sector living within its means, as well as the retention of job-creating capital in the private sector. AOI also supports other critical changes alongside SJR 26 to support job and income growth. For example, AOI believes that Oregon's tax rate on capital gains is uncompetitive and counterproductive for investment and job growth. We believe this rate must be lowered substantially. And Oregon's high gross receipts-based corporate minimum tax must either be lowered across the board or changed so as not to permanently hamstring Oregon industries that are high volume and low margin. In conclusion, I want to make an observation and a comment about a significant strategic objective of AOI from our board of directors and its management. And that's that I'm sitting here with our partners. We are very collaborative. AOI is not going to step out away from our partners as we collaborate with working with you on these issues. These folks and the organizations they represent are significant partners of AOI. There are others probably in the room behind me. The business community wants to work together with you and help come to a conclusion with this legislation that really moves Oregon forward. I want to thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee for this opportunity to comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sandra McDonough, and I am President and CEO of the Portland Business Alliance. We have about 1,400 members from the Portland metropolitan region, representing about 325,000 employees in that region. First of all, I want to thank Chair Burdick and Senator Morris for starting this very important discussion about how we can address Oregon's budget and revenue roller coaster. It is a conversation that is long overdue. Second, like my colleagues here today, I believe that discussions about creation of a rainy day fund must follow the hard but necessary work of reforming the delivery of state services and the budget realignment called for in the governor's budget and in the recommendations of the Reset Committee. Without budget and service delivery reforms, a rainy day fund can't be effective. The Alliance, like the other business organizations here today, has long advocated for a more robust rainy day fund to provide stability for critical state services such as K-12 education, higher ed, economic development, and human services. Oregon's reliance on an income tax makes our general fund revenue stream the most volatile in the nation. Effective long-range budgeting is frankly impossible under these circumstances. When the economy is booming, revenue, much of it related to one-time only capital gains, goes up dramatically. The legislature typically spends all of that new revenue as if it were an ongoing resource, establishing a new higher baselines for current services and future budgets. But inevitably, the economy cools, profits and capital gains dry up, and resulting in dramatic current services budget cuts like the one we're facing this year. The kicker has not proven to be an effective tool in stabilizing state budgets. It does not truly trim the upswings in state spending, and at the same time, it prevents the state from setting aside money when you need it when the economy is not so good. The Alliance believes it is critical to the state's future that we finally fix this problem, and we believe your proposal is a significant step in the right direction. The Alliance supports the creation and better funding of a rainy day fund that is big enough to sustain us during the most historical downturns. We support putting the rules for accessing that fund into the Constitution so that the public will feel confident that it will only be used for its intended purposes. We agree that both kickers should be adjusted to capitalize the rainy day fund, but should also continue to return excess revenues to taxpayers. And we also believe that there must be a real contribution to the from the general fund to discipline the legislature to save money when times are good so that it is available when they are not. Finally, we believe these changes should be made in the context of a review of the Oregon tax structure with an emphasis on job creation and economic development. Specifically, we believe Oregon's exceptionally high capital gains rates discourage investment and job creation in the state, and they should be reduced. There needs to be a sunset on the top personal tax rate imposed under ballot measure 66, and there needs to be strategic adjustments to the corporate minimum tax as it impacts low-margin, high-volume businesses. The recent economic analysis conducted by our four organizations in the Port of Portland showed that Oregon has fewer and lower paying jobs than the national average. We all recognize that an income tax-fueled general fund relies on good paying jobs. Oregon doesn't have a budget gap, it has an earnings gap. A rainy day fund alone is an important part of the answer. But we must recognize also that we will only solve the problem in the state's budget cap when we close the earnings gap by enabling the creation and retention of more quality private sector jobs. Taken together, these changes hold the promise of putting the state on a more stable fiscal foundation and opening the door for a more robust economic growth, two accomplishments that will benefit the state and citizens for generations to come. Thank you again for this opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee who have worked so hard for so many years on this particular issue. I am Ryan Deckert, the president of the Oregon Business Association. Delighted to be here with my peers who we've worked very hard in the last year, really talking about the core issues facing the state of Oregon and in agreement with the two prior speakers. And the way we've viewed this issue is that this would be step two in a five-step process. The first step, and frankly, the governor did a tremendous job at this, in incorporating this budget, really looking at the three cost drivers. What's growing in state government and what is not? And we, and I know this panel knows very well what's not growing, which is your education system, your post-secondary education system, but the other areas that are growing and really facing those head on. And so the governor did it in his budget. We're hoping that the legislature embraces that approach in the next 5 months and then takes this issue on as step two. And I can tell you, having sat through numerous hearings on this topic on both sides of the dais, this time it feels more real. Looking at the resolve of the state senators that we've talked to, of this panel and the composition of this panel, and just the general discussions that we've had around the state, as Mr. Wrighton spoke to, and to your colleagues, it feels more real this time that you're going to tackle big, audacious issues. And I can't think of one that comes more to the top, if you look at the fiscal track record of the state of the last two decades, than a stability package. And so having worked with a couple of the senators that are involved on this issue, I think it's been a long time coming that you get to this day. I thank you for scheduling it relatively early in the session. That gives us time to have some of the discussions that Sandy and Jay mentioned, and we will lend our shoulder, along with many, many more that I think are emerging around this issue, to see this through to the governors, and then, frankly, at the ballot as well, because we have to convince our fellow Oregonians that this is the right approach. I thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. One of the challenges I face now, working so collaboratively with my partners here, is by the time it gets to the fourth speaker, I really have nothing to say. So briefly, I concur with everything that's been said. I mean, I do think, as you know, that the business plan this year set out is improving our fiscal health and getting our fiscal house in order as the number one priority for the state's economic future. This is critical. And as we presented it, we need to have goals for our fiscal system. We need to focus on the economy, education, health care and protection for the vulnerable, public safety. And we need to have some outcomes in mind in each of those areas for the next 10 years and beyond. And we need to have a 10-year plan to get there, including looking at the major drivers, as Ryan mentioned, the major budget drivers, with a focus on those outcomes. We will not reach those outcomes unless we have stability. We need the revenue available in good times and bad. And without the stability fund, without having a reserve fund, and we simply can't get there. That's why we have put kicker reform on the plate for a number of years. It was in the Revenue Stability Task Force, along with the long-term budgeting recommendations. If you put all these pieces together, you have a huge opportunity to really drive Oregon forward. But it does need to include all the elements of budget reform, looking at the revenue, the tax structure, including, you know, targeted changes to promote economic growth on capital gains and other features, and building the stability fund. So I appreciate your leadership. This is the right time. We're looking forward to working with you. Thanks.
Thank you. And we'll probably have more discussions on this, and next time we'll start with you and work our way down the other way.
Thanks.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Okay. Now we have Julie O'Dwyer, Rebecca Schroeder, Ursula Marinelli, and Mike Hyland. And we already have four chairs up here, so just leave that chair there. Great stickers. I actually have a blue umbrella. I meant to bring it to the hearing.
Okay.
Welcome to all of you. Start in whatever order you like.
I'm going to go first. Esteemed committee, my name is Julie O'Dwyer, and I live in rural Redland in Oregon City. I'm here in support of creating a robust and funded rainy day reserve to improve the stability of school funding, and in hopes that reforming the kicker would also help begin to improve our investment in public education in this state. First, I'd like to talk about how unstable school funding has affected my son's education. In his first 3 years of elementary school, we were shocked to learn budget cuts meant no programs for PE, music, or library. Although PE and music returned for a couple of years, the PE position was cut again by the time his little sister started school. The music teacher had become part-time. The librarian position has never been replaced. During the last 3 years of my son's elementary education, he was in a classroom of 37, 38, and 39 kids, respectively. Like many parents, we felt our son was gifted, although he never tested as such. I sensed that he was bored in the classroom. And then at his first sixth grade conference, the teacher told us that in all his years of teaching, he could not recall having a student with the reading skills of a college senior. I wondered, was his intellect potential being stunted by class size? This frustrated mom went to the principal and asked what we could do for this child and others like him in a class of 39 students. Our principal contacted a retired high school math teacher to assist in pulling out high-achieving sixth-grade students once a week to begin advanced algebra studies. The payoff was fully realized when we attended the Oregon City High School Honors Banquet in the spring of our son's senior year. I looked around the room, and by far the majority of the kids there to be honored as the cream of the crop had been students in that pull-out math class from Redland Elementary. And her son, having been one of two achieving 4.0 GPA for all 4 years of high school, was valedictorian and will graduate in May with a biochemistry degree from Lewis and Clark College. Success, you say? For a few, perhaps. But what for those who fell through the cracks in an unmanageable sized classes? Or continue to? Not much has changed. When I got involved with the Coalition for School Funding Now in 1998, I had no idea I'd be in front of you 13 years later as a member of Stanford Children, still asking you to address the stability of school funding issue. It makes me wonder how many kids were lucky enough to have an advocate or a tenacious parent such as my son's and have been shorted a great education in Oregon because we still haven't solved this problem. I urge you, no, I implore you to convince your colleagues on both sides, both bodies in the Capitol, to finally establish a real rainy day fund so that we can stop further increases to class sizes and get every single child in the state of Oregon the education they deserve for the future, for their future and yours. Thank you in advance for reaching across the aisle to see that this request finally comes to fruition this session.
Thank you. I'll go next. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Schroeder, and I live in Northeast Portland. I have two young girls, ages 7 and 5. I'm an active member of Stanford Children, and I'm also a teacher. I have a master's in education, and I taught children with hearing loss for several years prior to the birth of my children. So I care about stabilizing education funding for many reasons. I care about how instability in funding affects my past and future students. Obviously, I care how it affects my own children. And as an advocate for children, I care about how it affects all children and families in Oregon. Sadly, I've directly experienced the consequences that instability in state funding can have on our public schools. In the fall of 2008, our oldest daughter entered kindergarten. We researched all our options for schools, both public and private. We were happy to find that our neighborhood school, which is just a few blocks from our house, offered pretty much everything we were looking for. Excellent teachers, committed and involved families, and quality enrichment to the core curriculum, including music and library skills, and even weekly lessons in a second language. When the budget was set for that school year, the economy was still strong and things were looking pretty good. The state had just sent back $1 million in kicker checks, and the longtime principal at our daughter's school was enjoying the first year she had not had to make any cuts to staffing or programs. Of course, later that fall, the state of the economy changed dramatically, and the Oregon legislature was facing a $1 billion shortfall. Cuts to the education budget had to be made. I remember attending a coffee chat with the principal in late winter, at which she was preparing all the parents for the cuts soon to come. She mentioned getting rid of our librarian, cutting back on PE and music, increasing class sizes in some grades, eliminating the second language classes, and cutting electives for middle school students. Knowing that future years were likely to bring more cuts, my husband and I made the decision to send our daughter to private school starting the following fall. We knew we just couldn't stomach the instability in funding and the effects it would have on the quality of our daughter's education over the long term. And we are not alone. We know many families from a variety of socioeconomic backgrounds who have left their neighborhood schools these past few years because of unstable funding. But we gave up a lot by choosing not to have our daughters attend our neighborhood school. We gave up that blissfully short walk to school and the ease of forming friendships with their neighborhood peers. We gave up many opportunities to be involved in supporting our neighborhood school community. We gave up the deep connection to our neighborhood that we felt when our daughter attended the local school. These things are of great value to us. By creating a robust rainy day fund, you have the opportunity to allow public school principals to plan ahead more than 1 year at a time. With stable funding, principals and teachers can create sustainable educational programs for their students. Students won't have to worry every year about whether their favorite subject will be cut or their favorite new teacher laid off. During this time when the terrible effects of not having a rainy day fund are so apparent, you have a unique opportunity to address the long-term stability funding that we need for vital state services, including education. Please take this important step for Oregon's children. Thank you.
My name is Ursula Marinelli. I live at 215 Northwest 1st Street in Newport, Oregon. Thank you for considering the establishment of a rainy day fund to help our state's most vulnerable populations, including our youth. Since August of 1999, I've lived in Newport with my husband, Jeffrey Gavin, and our daughter, Domenica, who is currently a sophomore at Newport High School. Domenica has had the benefit of learning from many wonderful teachers during her 10 years in the Lincoln County Public School District. Unfortunately, those 10 years have also been fraught with uncertainty and instability. Since we arrived in Lincoln County, 4 school buildings have been closed. Students are shifted each year, placing elementary, middle school, and high school students in the same buildings. 1 year, Newport High School math class held so many students that the fire marshal cited the school. The classroom had exceeded the maximum number of students for fire safety. Instead of splitting the students into 2 classes, they removed a wall to enlarge the room. The school had no choice. We did not have the funds to provide another teacher for our kids. One of the biggest losses for our community came with the early retirement of a beloved music teacher this past year, Christine McKinney. For many years, Mrs. McKinney taught music to all students, grades 1 through 5, at Yaquina View Elementary School. Domenica was among the hundreds of students who learned to read and appreciate music, play the keyboard, and sing in the choir, thanks to this gifted teacher. Every year, Mrs. McKinney was told that her music program would most likely be cut due to lack of funding. Every year, somehow, the school would find a way to keep the music program intact. In the spring of 2010, Mrs. McKinney was once again told that the music program may have to be cut. The uncertainty made it impossible for her to plan her professional and personal life. The compounded stress finally took its toll, and she opted for an early retirement. In the summer of 2010, she learned that the Newport Elementary music program would survive thanks to federal stimulus dollars, but it was too late. She told me that if she had known with certainty that the program would survive, she would still be teaching. By the way, Yaquina View Elementary School was one of them that was closed in the past 2 years. We have watched families leave the state, and in 2 cases, leave the country, seeking better educational opportunities for our children. The instability of our foreign language program is a major sore spot for parents who understand the global nature of our economy. Today, at one time, Newport High School offered students 4 different language programs. Today, Spanish is the only language offered. Domenica did not start learning Spanish until her freshman year in high school. By the time she entered 6th grade, the middle school language program had already been gone for several years due to lack of funding. This year, 7th and 8th graders in Newport Prep Academy are once again offered a Spanish course every other day. However, 7th and 8th graders in Newport's Isaac Newton Magnet School are still not offered a foreign language because of a lack of funding. Administrators hope that someday they will be able to offer Spanish to all 7th and 8th graders every day. Do we dare to dream that big? Domenica attended the Isaac Newton Magnet School for 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. This school's charter places an emphasis on art and science. At the beginning of her 8th grade year, a group of parents was assembled to raise funds for art supplies. We were told that the funding source that traditionally purchased art supplies was no longer available. A school established to specifically focus on art and science was not consistently given the resources it needed to purchase paper and paints. We wrote a fundraising letter, and parents responded favorably, and so our children had their art supplies. In the spring of every year, Newport High School students submit their choices for electives for the following year. Last year, Domenica requested journalism, creative writing, and or choir. She plans to pursue a career in writing. At registration in the fall, we learned that the creative writing class would not be offered at all, although it had been offered the previous year. Choir was not an option for her either, because only one choir class was offered, and it conflicted with the only advanced English sophomore class available, which she was required to take. There were 40 students in her advanced English class. How many writing assignments do you think one teacher could correct for 40 students? Our daughter's experience is the norm, not the exception. Because of unstable funding, many electives were either cut or offered on a limited basis, and the required classes are unreasonably large. She was able to take the journalism class, and I have copies of her latest newspaper that I will leave here. Parents, teachers, and students are willing to partner with the state to do the things that we can do. They have a newspaper because they sell ads, and they're able to print it with the refund or with the revenues from those sales. We will raise money for art supplies. We will do things like host exchange students to open a bigger world to our rural kids. But we need the state to provide consistent teachers in classrooms that have a reasonable student-teacher ratio. Thank you very much for considering this important legislation.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hyland. I am a school parent and resident of Sherwood, Oregon for the last 15 years. I am raising my children here. This is my home. My family has been through two economic recessions, and we have seen drastic cuts in our kids' school each time. I have watched their class sizes increase, class days diminish, and important services like library and computer access cut. I have watched parents fight over funding for sports programs versus academic programs versus art and music programs. I have participated in two local option campaigns to raise money for my schools, both of which we lost. I worked to pass Measure 66 and 67, regretting that we had to ask for more taxes during hard times, but knowing that the cuts would be too severe without this and that we had no choice. Both times I've been in Salem talking to my reps about passing a rainy day fund to end this mess. We all failed our kids last time. Let's not do it again. A recession causes around 20 to 25% drop in revenues. We cannot maintain a healthy school system with these types of fluctuations. Everybody knows this. Every speaker has commented on this. The only answer is to save during the good times and keep funding more stable. No other single education reform issue is as important as this one. If we do nothing else, let's fix this now, this time. Senate Joint Resolution 26 would create a rainy day fund that will strengthen our schools, our families, and our business climate in Oregon. These three things are inseparable. It provides a stability fund for K-12 and higher education. It takes from both the kicker and the general fund. Once a specific level is reached, the fund is sealed, and it can only be used during economic downturns. I am tired of having to fight so hard for something that is just plain common sense. In the Bible, God sent a dream to Moses, telling him to save during the good times so that Egypt could survive the famine. Let's save Oregon. Let's create a prosperity that will serve our children and their children as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, next witness is Steve Buckstein.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit public policy research organization based in Portland. I was on Governor Kulongowski's task force for revenue restructuring, as were the chair and Senator Morse. And I was appointed to that task force to represent taxpayers. And I consider myself still doing that in analyzing proposals, resolutions like this one. First of all, I think, as you know, taxpayers have very few ways to control the growth of government in this state, the growth of the budget. The kicker law, flawed as it may be, and flawed as I agree it is one of those ways, and I wouldn't want to see it weakened unless something better can take its place. I understand and applaud your current effort here to get a better handle on the growth of government spending and to build a rainy day fund. If this resolution sought to modify or even replace the kicker with a permanent comprehensive population and inflation limit on budget growth, I'd be, I think, more interested in supporting it than I am currently. As I read the resolution, it would reduce the kicker's benefit to personal taxpayers, to personal income taxpayers, and end the benefit entirely to corporate taxpayers, while only imposing the spending limit until the new rainy day fund reached a certain level, basically 12% of the general fund. Second, the resolution assumes that the kicker law has prevented the state from building a substantial rainy day fund already, when in reality, there is no prohibition against lawmakers spending less than the revenue forecast currently and saving the balance for a rainy day. I know it's politically difficult. I've talked with you about that. I understand that, but it's legal for you to do that. And in the governor's current proposed budget, he's projecting to, quote-unquote, invest the additional 8% revenue over the revenue that will be available in the general fund this biennium. He's projecting to invest, quote-unquote, 8%. You have 3% in there, three out of the 8, to start a rainy day fund if you want to. You don't have to invest it as he wishes. You could start the rainy day fund without asking the taxpayers for anything. So rather than delve into more of the details of this proposal, on the back of the prepared testimony that I gave you, I'm sorry I don't have enough copies here for everyone, I reprinted a chart that we have in our latest budget analysis called Facing Reality, which shows what would have happened if Measure 48, which was a population and inflation spending limit, had been enacted in 2006. It was on the ballot. It was defeated by the voters, but it shows what would have happened from then on, 2007 on, if that had been passed. And you can also see on this chart what would happen if you simply imposed a population and inflation limitation from now on, starting with this biennium. Basically, what it does is turn the decade of deficits that Governor Kulongowski's reset cabinet said would occur into a decade of surpluses. And if the measure, if Measure 48 had been imposed, had been passed in 2006, you wouldn't be seeing a current service level deficit of $3.5 billion this biennium. And I applaud the governor for not relying on that, for actually putting forward a balanced budget. But you wouldn't even have a current service level deficit of $3.5 billion. You'd have a quote-unquote balanced budget this biennium if that spending limit had been imposed in 2006. You can't do that. You can't go back and impose it now. But if you started it in this biennium, you see that basically the orange line, which basically is the state revenue forecast that's already out there, and the, what I call the Measure 48 expenditure line going out to biennium 2015-17, you're looking at a decade, or at least the next couple of bienniums, of surpluses. And so that's what I would ask you to focus on. I think if you did focus on a comprehensive spending limit, I personally would be much more interested in saying alter or eliminate the kicker. But without some kind of long-term spending limitation, what I'm afraid of is you fill up the 12% rainy day fund in this measure. Times are good. You get additional revenue. You spend it on programs that are not sustainable, as has happened in the past. And we're right back here talking about how we deal with deficits in the future. I don't think it really adds to stability. It may be a short-term solution, but I would propose looking more long-term at controlling government spending. Thank you.
Question, Madam Chair. Senator
Morse. Thank you, and thank you, Steve, for coming and testifying. As has been calculated by our legislative revenue office, if you go back to the decades of the 90s and the impact of initiatives, what we found is that I think it was about 2007, as I recall, Paul, that nearly 50% of the growth in general fund expenditures was directly attributed to initiatives that were imposed by voters. And my question would be, how would you accommodate a strict spending cap in a state that has a very active initiative system?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, we've talked about this before, and as you know, I think as I read the Oregon Constitution, the citizens are a co-equal branch of the legislature with the 90 people in this building. They are proposing initiatives, most of which are rejected. Historically, most of the initiatives that have been placed on the ballot have been rejected. Those that have been approved, obviously the citizens wanted them. And I think that you have dealt with that. And I would say that you need to continue to look at that. If citizens see that the growth of spending is reduced and you can build up a surplus, in other words, looking at this chart, by 2015-2017, you'd have close to a $3 billion surplus, everything else being equal. You could use that to bolster a much bigger rainy day fund than you're talking about. You could do tax reductions, or you could fund initiatives that are coming up that you may not be aware of. In other words, there's a lot of quote-unquote revenue on the table if you restrain the growth in the current level of government services.
Thank you.
Senator Hass.
Thank you. Steve, I think you noted that the voters defeated that measure in Oregon. I think it was about a 70-30 margin. And I think one of the reasons they did was because the state of Colorado, 4 or 5 years previous to that, had passed a taxpayer bill of rights, as it's called. And it sounds very appealing, and limiting growth sounds appealing. But in reality, as we've discussed in this committee with Dr. Warner, it has a ratcheting down effect. And in Colorado, it almost wrecked their universities. And several years after they voted it in, they then later rescinded it. And to my knowledge, I don't think there's any states that have this this kind of a spending limit in place now, such as what was presented back then, because it doesn't work.
Senator Burdick, Senator Hass, the ratchet down effect was, I think, responsible, you're right, for causing serious problems and for the alteration of that measure. You don't have to have a ratchet down in a measure in Oregon. You could propose a measure that, based on your forecast, your revenue and your spending forecast, if revenue dipped down, you don't have to restart the clock there. You could continue on the population and inflation level and catch up, so to speak, when times are good. I agree. It's the same problem you have, as you say it, with the kicker, that when times are good, you have to, anything extra that you think you want to save goes back to taxpayers. There doesn't have to be a ratchet down in a population and inflation measure. You can learn from Colorado, and Oregon can be the first to do it better.
Thank you. All right. We have Tim Dewey has arrived to give us some thoughts on this measure, and Tim, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, thank you. Tim Dewey, University of Oregon.
We had talked on the phone, and you had looked at the measure, and I think you had some observations about the mandatory savings provision.
Yes.
Of the
amendment. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the committee and our leadership for bringing together a bipartisan attempt to get at this issue. I think that trying to find a rational rainy day fund in a politically acceptable context is an important thing for the state to work its way toward. I had a couple thoughts on the initial proposal. I think my first thought was that I think it's important to start moving away from the idea that inflation plus population growth is some kind of a valid measure. Certainly the state economy is going to grow at a rate that's bigger than that, faster than that. And it's almost for certain that you'll end up ratcheting down spending in any way, shape, or form with that kind of spending limitation. I think a more rational spending limitation, if you're going to approach that kind of view, is thinking about the state's economy and the growth of the state economy. Spending limitation somewhere around that kind of number, which would be a little bit faster than the population plus inflation growth, would be something that over the long term would attempt to, at a baseline, freeze the size of government relative to the rest of the economy. So wouldn't ratchet it up or wouldn't ratchet it down as a baseline expectation of where we expected government spending to grow over a period of time. So I would think that a little bit higher expectation than inflation plus population growth would be the appropriate measure from there. I think it's nice, appropriate to set a break at that point and say, all right, once we have achieved a increase in the size of the government relative to, or not an increase, an increase in the size that holds a proportion relative to the government as a whole, to the economy as a whole, I think that's a nice place to set a break and say, okay, we're going to save going forward and save a percentage point after, or 3 percentage points in this case, after that, to establish that rainy day fund to, in fact, start to compensate for future shortfalls. I did agree with our previous speaker that these are some basic principles that we could, in fact, enact and should consider enacting, I think, even in the absence of some kicker reform, because they are in some they are common sense. So I do think that's true, although I also agree that in very good times we should be saving for the future, and if we do have a surplus over our expectations, that a portion of that should be reverted to saving for the future. Another thought I had is listening to some of the previous testimony that I wouldn't want to oversell what could be accomplished by this measure. There's certain kinds of shortfalls that it would be good to, it would compensate for. For example, a typical, I would say, pre-2000 recession where job growth was fast enough during the recovery to offset the recession and move, return us to trend. This was a very difficult decade. No amount of rainy day fund was going to solve some of the problems that we had this decade. Relative to the steady service goals, we're facing a $3.5 billion deficit in perpetuity. There wouldn't be a saving rainy day fund sufficient to deal with that. This was a very, again, atypical decade from a lot of perspectives, and I don't think we could have built a big enough rainy day fund to forestall some of the problems that we're going to have going forward. So I think that's important to keep in mind is what is our ultimate, what's our ultimate objective here? And I think our ultimate objective is to stabilize state funding in the scope of what I think of as a normal economy or normal recessionary periods. But I think it's very difficult to stabilize in the scope of this particular
Well, but even though it certainly wouldn't have done the job, it certainly would have softened things had we had...
It would have certainly eased the transition and softened the blow. And that's why I would still, of course, it still is the appropriate way to go. It's just the issue of making sure our expectations are in check of what we can accomplish. I would be very surprised if we had another decade like this. And so I think it's good to take the lesson of this decade and apply it going forward. And if we don't have another decade like this, then I think a funding mechanism of this type will be sufficient to smooth out those fluctuations and would be appropriate. Essentially, I think if you manage it something closer to the rate of growth of the economy, then during a very super, very strong economy, especially if you did it with a lagging, sort of the past 3-year average, during a very rapid period of economic growth, I think government spending as a share of the economy would probably decrease. This would be a counter-cyclical policy, which would be good, and then you'd have the opportunity to increase it during a recession, which I think would be, again, counter-cyclical and an appropriate way to manage the state's finances. Would that overall goal of, at least an overall guideline of the pace of growth of the economy, of the government spending, being somewhat in line with the pace of growth of the economy?
Okay, well, I really appreciate your coming, and I would like to work with you, and I think I speak for others on the committee, to try to get some metric in there that actually works and that doesn't end up having unintended consequences.
Yes, well, I'm more than happy to work with the state on that.
Thank you, and thank you for coming up from Eugene. Is there anything else, other observations you want to add before I open it for questions?
No, off the top of my head. Feel free to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you. And thank you for coming, Tim. I'm struck by remembering the California analysis of the elasticity of the sales tax versus an income tax. That was a 20-year, I believe, analysis. And as I recall, the findings of that study was that when the economy expanded, an income tax system tended to over-deliver compared to a consumption tax. And I'm wondering if you had an index that was driven by the economy, would you have an unrealistic revenue inflation that would occur beyond what really the economy is supporting?
I don't think so. I've thought about this. I've thought about this exact question. I think that if you used the lag of the growth of the government, so that if you had a superheated period of time, that you wouldn't grow spending to account for that. You'd grow spending at a rate that accounted for something in the past 3 years when it wasn't quite superheated, and that would contain the rate at which you could grow. And it would work on the other side, too. If you had a deep recession, you'd still be expecting growth to increase at the past lagging rate. So I think if you had a smoothed approach based on your recent lag behavior, I think you can get away with that issue. But also, this is why it's important, in a sense, because the way our system works is so that on the upside, particularly if we have a lot of gains for upper-income individuals and you have these surge of revenues above what we expected, that's where having that cap in place and saying, okay, we can't spend above our 15, whatever our forecast is, at that point, then turning around and giving that back to the taxpayers or giving that back to the state, that's retaining that portion of it then also helps, I think, limit the upside approach. So I think that actually this puts in some mechanisms that helps avoid that exact problem that I think many of us are concerned about.
Let me just ask you a general question. You know, we're obviously struggling with how to structure this. What, you know, where we put things in the Constitution, and where we might think of putting things statutorily. Do you have what is your confidence level of being able to get some kind of a formula that would work on the mandatory savings? The kicker part is pretty straightforward, but right. The mandatory savings part. What is your level of confidence that if we decided to put it in the Constitution where it would be very, very difficult to change it, what's your level of confidence that we could devise something that would stand the test of time?
I'm fairly confident of this. This is something that's been – I've spent some time thinking about this week in this issue. I think if you can manage a couple different measures. I think the growth in the government, the size of the government is something that, or excuse me, the growth in the size of the economy overall is something that could be resilient in the Constitution. But also the other feature that I like is that that's not necessarily a firm limitation, because if you did have very high growth in revenues, that there'd be some wiggle room above your savings rate to work with. And so this is an interesting proposal because it has both some rigidities and some flexibilities. And finding proposals that manage both of those well is difficult. And I'm somewhat impressed, really impressed that we've been able to find a proposal that starts to try to manage that balance between flexibility and rigidity. That you set up basic guidelines of how we think. You think about it. It's kind of like a family setting a budget. We're going to spend X percent, and we're going to save Y percent. And anything on top of that, we're going to have to make a different decision above. But it's got, I think, the possibility where this could be a very resilient type of approach.
Thank you. Senator Hess.
Thank you. One of the things that makes us somewhat different than a family budget is that in economic downturns, the services and the demands on government actually increase. And more people go to universities because they've lost their jobs. And so that's where some of these, where some of the rigidity starts to bump into the realities. And so I was just wondering if you saw a way to deal with these opposite curves going in different directions in a measure like this.
I think that actually it does. Again, that's why I kind of like this lagging indicator, because during downturns, then you're sort of using as a baseline spending growth what was going on in the previous 3 years, which would be an upturn. So your assumption built into the system would be that during a downturn, actually the growth of government relative to the rest of the economy should expand, which is the countercyclical policy. And then that's what we want. And we want, on the upside, the relative proportion of the government to actually shrink. So we again have the countercyclical policy. So I think that with the proper metric in place, we can inject that countercyclical element to address that issue, although none of that works unless you have the money to back it up, right? And so really what makes that countercyclical behavior work is that you, in fact, are establishing the rainy day fund on the upside so that you have it to fill the gap on the downside. In the absence of that mechanism, we're stuck with that. We're rigid. we're rigid as well. So I think that again, if we take the two basic viewpoints, that one, we need a rainy day fund, but also we need some establishment, some idea of what we believe the rate of government growth should be. If we take those two ideas and try to combine them, we're closing in on something that actually works. But as we all see, it's not incredibly easy or obvious. This is something of a challenge, and it's again good that we're really undertaking that challenge.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Tom Stutzman. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Burdick. My name is Tom Stutzman. I'm, along with my wife, I'm a president and CEO of a small family that lives out in Monmouth. I'd like to talk about something a little bit different than what I've heard here tonight or this afternoon. I've heard everybody up to this point talk pretty much in favor of the rainy day fund and how we can expand it. I'd like to bring you back to where that money actually comes from in the first place. It comes from individuals such as myself and small business owners all over Oregon, where that money is used typically to raise a family and to run our businesses. If you guys keep more of our money in the end, I mean, that's less money in the private sector for us to run our own businesses and to expand and to create jobs and to create new products. To me, the bottom line is not whether a rainy day fund is a good thing. Obviously, it is. But what comes down to the bottom line for me is that if my numbers are correct, in the last biennium, you guys approved $170 million of new first-time funding. I've looked at many of the bills that are before you guys in the House this biennium, and there's many, 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 many of them that are new programs, new commissions, new funding sources, new government entities, new laws, that if we could just stop where we're at and stop creating or stop adding to what we are already apparently overburdened by, because apparently we're $3 billion in the hole right now. I mean, it seems to me that if you're in a hole already and you're wanting to add more and more and more services on top of what we already can't fund, it makes funding schools appropriately harder. It makes funding the things that are really important to us as individuals harder to do. The more you pile on, the less money there is for everything else that's, well, what most of us would consider essential. Police and fire and schools and the things that we all use, that we all need. And I mean, that's all I've got to say. I mean, I'd just like you to consider of where the money comes from in the first place, and maybe not spend so much of it this time, and then give back to where it belongs in the original hands, so we can expand our own lives and our own businesses. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You do the same. Okay. Now we'll take Lori Wimmer and Ralph Groner. And John Bartholomew. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, and we're very pleased to be here today, along with a couple hundred of our members in the building, who are here to help you through this session with respect to the funding crisis in front of you. And we are here to thank you for your long time work on this issue, all of you. We know that you want what we want, which is a more fiscally responsible, prudently managed, and adequate system of funding the vital services Oregonians have come to expect and need. We also know that SJR 26 is just a starting point for the conversation this session, and we hope that you take as constructive the comments that I've included in my written testimony to you about both the positives and the negatives of the bill, of the resolution as written. Overall, I can summarize by saying that we have for a very long time been in support of both adequate reserving and using the kicker to do that. It makes sense. There's some synchronicity in the idea that when you have unanticipated revenues, you put them in the piggy bank so that when the cycle goes downward, you then have the resources to minimize the impact services that everyone in Oregon knows is all about the quality of life and preservation of a good economy. We do believe that, as written, there are some problems with the measure, and I have listed those. I also wanted to point out that we keep hearing in the building, and though that this is not to the bill, that there are proposals that ultimately would be linked with this package to do such things as the capital gains tax cut. It's been mentioned today, so I don't think this is a novel point. And we want to say for the record that we would categorically oppose something that does not guarantee any job creation in Oregon and just eliminates tax share for the upper income earners. What we think we would most like you to pay attention to as you move forward is the idea of creating a consensus package, and we'd be very pleased to be a part of any work group that you might choose to put together to create a final package to bring to the voters. But what we would not like to see in the final package is a population spending cap. I think you've heard from Dr. Dewey and others that that's probably not the best way to link our controls on government. We have currently, what by my count, in effect, three spending caps as it is. We have the amount of revenue that we have because of the balanced budget amendment, and we can't appropriate more than we believe we'll bring in. That's one. We have a personal income limit spending cap on the general fund that was enacted in 2001 or revised in 2001, originally imposed in 79. That's two. And the kicker itself, I would argue, is a third spending cap. So I don't know that we need a fourth, and certainly not a draconian fourth. As far as the reserve accounts themselves, I meant to attach and failed to, but I'll make sure you have it by email, a best practices manual from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, why and how states should strengthen their rainy day funds. And they list a number of best practices for reserving. And we do well on some of their recommendations, but poorly on others. Here's a quick summary of the list. They say that state reserves should be adequate, that they should be accessible when they're needed, that they should be fully utilizable, that means every dime of them, quickly recapitalized, and finally flexibly construed to meet the changing needs over time of the state and its people. Earmarking a fund for particular uses only is not flexibility, and that is, we believe, one of the flaws of the current resolution. Finally, when it comes to accessible and fully utilizable, accessibility by their definition means that you shouldn't have to have a supermajority to access the use of the fund, because that's ruled by the minority by another name. Capitalization and sufficiency and speed, I think, are the main focuses that we should concentrate on in creating a package for this time, because these are the issues that remain central to our budget stability in Oregon. And we really support making sure that that is the focus of your work on this measure. There's a growth index that's listed in this bill, and if I understand it correctly, in effect, it would just add more instability and uncertainty, not less, by use of it in the formula as it's drawn out, because it's still based on estimates. And the problem with kicker that makes it so destabilizing to Oregon is that that is based on the best educated guesses of our talented economists and not actual receipts. Kicker reform itself needs to be based on an understandable method of dealing with unanticipated resources, and it needs to align with our citizens' values of common sense and fairness. And we believe that all such resources on the corporate side ought to be capitalized, ought to be retained to capitalize the reserves. And on the other side, only as research suggests, it might be construed and be able to pass voter muster. We also finally would say that the pot sweeteners that have been proposed, such as the trades, the budget trades that would be constitute bad public policy from our perspective, we would urge you not to go there. That would be a deal that we would really hope would not happen this time around. And one of the reasons for that is, with respect to the capital gains piece especially, is that capital gains cut revenue could be invested in increased mechanization, which would actually limit jobs, not create them, and there would be really no way to ensure that it would have the stimulus effect you desire. By contrast, when you invest in public education, for example, at a greater rate, you're actually directly stimulating the economy of Oregon by helping to support the second largest employer in the state, the public schools, and stimulate the economies of Main Street, Oregon. As I said, we'd be happy to work with you further on this. We have several different ideas about how a good package might look, and we stand ready to be there when we hear your call.
Thank you, and we will take you up on that. We're running out of time, so if you could keep it very short, Mr. Groner, and you too, Mr. Bartholomew, because I got one more witness I want to get up here.
I will, for once, read a short page, so I'll be very succinct. For the record, Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME, and I really appreciate the statesmanship of you bringing this forward. I'm excited. There's no doubt that there's a need for the kicker as a parent. I've always supported that. The specifics, we may need to do some work. So we all know that. I'm going to make a few, I hope, in civility. I'm going to say there should be private sector jobs created and public sector jobs. I just listened on OPB as the teachers' colleges are saying they're down 40% to 50% recruitment, and that epitomizes part of the problem if we start pitting one, and I won't do that, against the other. One is as important as the other. The Department of Human Resources budget, something like 90% goes out into the community and is spent by private business, creating business, and so forth. PPNL quote I want to play on, customers expect us to operate on a sustainable level, yet the voters have made Oregon's budget unsustainable. The perfect storm, recession, kicker returns when we needed the money, remember the billion deficit, billion out, tax expenditures and voter-approved ballot measures. Measure 5 and 50 have cost us this biennium $4 billion increase if you took the 70% criteria. Don't count the 30 we used to contribute, just the 40 increase. That's a $4 billion increase and an 18% which have caused significant cuts at the state and local government level. And I have to argue with, I don't like that word, I'm sorry, disagree civilly with those who say that we need a major deterrent on government spending.
Okay, let's focus on the bill. And it's unfair to enforce that on
okay.
you, and I haven't on others, but there we have it.
Well, I'll close with this. The voters did not connect complicated dots on previous ballot measures to the tune of $4 billion this biennium increase. Now, voter initiative mandates have brought us to the cliff's edge, and at least as much as the recession itself has been caused by ballot measures by the voters, not the legislature. It is time for the voters to vote yes on kicker reform and partially rectify the predicament that we are currently in.
No, thank you very much. And again, I apologize for shortening
okay.
you up here.
Okay.
John.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, statewide consumer group with over 10,000 members across the state. I'll just be brief. I mean, we support the creation of a real robust rainy day fund that will ensure greater stability of Oregon's budget. It comes from just the general perspective that, you know, any good family or business operation is going to say when we're in good times, we set aside some money for the bad times. And it's just a general principle that we believe is important to ensure that we continue to provide the services all Oregonians rely on. And I want to commend the process. The process thus far of finding bipartisan support, something that has been very inclusive, bringing in all sorts of different organizations, it's very encouraging, and we look forward to continuing this process too. As we look at the details of this particular proposal, I just want to point out the three things that we are going to be keeping our eye the most closely on. One is the size. Is the size, this 12% amount, is it going to be enough to really get us through the next recession? You know, what are the average revenue losses of the previous recessions? So that's the first thing. Is this going to be enough? Second, is the funding mechanism reliable enough to work quickly to replenish it before the next recession? Because we have been seeing every 7 to 8 years we're going to be hit by a recession. So is the funding mechanism quick enough before the next one? And third, we want to make sure that the rainy day fund will have a very clear policy on when it can and cannot be used so that you know, we can weather the recession, but it doesn't become a slush fund either. So as we look forward with the process of this, those are the three key things that we're going to be looking at from our perspective on whether or not to throw our full support behind it. So thank you very much for your time.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, last witnesses. I guess John, right? Ryan wants to come up. And Arthur.
I guess I'll start. My name is Arthur Towers. I'm political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And for brevity's sake, I will try not to repeat too many of the topics raised in the
first 2 hours of this hearing. But I did want to underscore the fact that this recession is an atypical one, and the recession is also, the recovery is also atypical in the sense that as corporate profits are growing, the capacity of the private sector to create jobs in the United States hasn't grown along with them, and that's creating quite the crisis, not just for Oregon's budget, but for state budgets across the country. Our union does indeed support kicker reform for many of the reasons that people have mentioned earlier in terms of stability and predictability. But again, the thing to remember is Senator Hess really got to the nub of is that government growth is countercyclical. We have record need. A number of our members are in the Capitol today talking to you about what's going on out in the community, the idea of, you know, homelessness mushrooming in Washington County. The idea that we have the number of folks coming in to get funding because they need help because of domestic violence is through the roof. You know, 1 out of 5 people on food stamps, 1 out of 6 on the health plan. I mean, we have record need here. And so we are nervous about the idea of the spending cap and do want to have further conversations with you about that. Senator Hess also touched on the will of the voters on this issue. More than 900,000 voters voted against a spending cap very similar to this just 5 years ago. And it wasn't just one county, all 36 counties. In fact, in 29 of the 36 counties, the measure was defeated by worse than 2-1. And so that's a big hill to climb if that's the direction that this body wants to go. And then I'll close with one idea I think that hasn't been discussed earlier on, and that is we talk about reining in the growth in state spending. There's a type of state spending that we haven't touched on at all today, and that's the mushrooming growth of state tax expenditures. And there's dozens upon dozens of bills that are before this body here this session to increase tax expenditures. I would be cautious about any sort of spending cap that doesn't rein in that type of expenditure as well. So I'll conclude my remarks there. Really appreciate the leadership you all are showing on this issue, and hopefully we can be constructive as we move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arthur. And I just want to just make it clear for the record that we are in SJR 26, we are not talking about a spending cap. We're talking about a threshold where savings would take place, and that's different. That's different than a thou shalt not spend. That means that after you get to some threshold, and I think we have highlighted this as an area we have to further examine where the threshold should be, but it's a cut, if you will, after that threshold is reached, after which if there's more money in the forecast, then that can go right back into the budget. So that's how it differs from a spending cap. But it's all there's a lot of semantics here and a lot of clarification, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm serving as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'll be extremely brief. I've already submitted written testimony, and many of the major points have already been covered. I just want to point out that long before I came along, the Human Services Coalition of Oregon has been very interested in pushing for better stability within the budget. In fact, they have a 20-year history of this being one of their points of emphasis. In the last several years, the Human Services Coalition has formed its own Tax and Revenue Committee, which has looked very closely at revenues, and particularly this issue of a kicker reform and building a robust state savings. So I just want to let you know that we are grateful, and the work of this committee is something that we're going to be tracking very closely and hopefully being able to lend our support to. We are still digesting SJR 26, and we're still taking it to that Tax Revenue Committee and crunching the numbers, but we are very excited about this effort. We support these efforts to improve stability because we represent the folks who are receiving the brunt of those countercyclical cycles that we talked about, the folks who really do need services when the economy is down. And so we'll be looking at this from their perspective. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. And I wanted to thank everyone who came to testify today. This has been a great discussion. As I said at the beginning, this is a work in progress. We are all in this together, and we will all get this done. Are there further questions for the committee? We are adjourned.